Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman, and I'm with you every Tuesday to discuss self-care and integrated health. Many years ago, psychologist Carl Jung postulated that the human soul could be split into male and female poles. More recently, led by the recovery movement, we're encouraged to connect with and nurture our inner child. Jokes and satire aside, this also represented a shift toward seeing ourselves as having two distinctly different personalities, requiring reunion and relationship. How we heal ourselves from trauma may now benefit from early research on patients with surgically split brains. In his dramatic new book, Of Two Minds, psychiatrist and researcher Dr. Frederick Schiffer unpacks the new science of dual brain psychology. So let me welcome my guest and make sure he's with us. Dr. Schiffer, are you there?
I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you, and give you an introduction. Frederick Schiffer, MD, is a psychiatrist. He's on the faculty at the Harvard Medical School and is associate attending psychiatrist at McLean Hospital. His writing has been published in the field's most prestigious publications, including the Journal of Neuropsychiatry, Comprehensive Psychiatry, and the Harvard Review of Psychiatry. Dr. Schiffer also maintains a clinical practice in adult psychiatry in Newton, Massachusetts. So welcome and thank you for taking time out.
Thank you.
I was impressed with the fact that after reviewing the press information about the book, before I actually started to read the book, that I had the impression that this was going to be really revolutionary in the sense that it was going to depart rather abruptly from the traditions of psychotherapy, Freud, and whatnot. And in fact, what I found was that it's really just an evolution of what existed before, I think, in many ways.
Yeah, I think actually it serves to explain psychotherapy.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, so it enhances it, it reinforces it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully... refines it and makes it more accurate.
Well, why don't you start out by telling us just a little about why this how this approach differs from, say, what you were you not trained as a Freudian? For the most part.
Well, it's sort of. I am not a psychoanalyst, but I'm. I would regard myself as what's called psychodynamically oriented, which means. Strongly influenced by psychoanalysis. And so I'm a talking psychiatrist as opposed to a biological psychiatrist, although I will prescribe medicine when I feel it's appropriate. It isn't the thing I'm most interested in, and I'm more interested in talking with people.
Well, from the perspective of most of the listeners of the show, they would put you in the camp of the good guys.
Good.
So what is basically different here from what came before? Where did we make a sudden turn here? What's different?
Okay, well, I think that what I'm doing clarifies psychology. I think that if you read Freud, or I loved reading Jung, but I don't know that I ever understood him.
I'm not sure that Jungians understand him.
You mentioned the male and female part, you know, the animus and the anima, and I'm not quite, you know, I mean, it's kind of a nice poetry, and I have a nice feeling when I read it, but I come away, you know, really not sure that I can put in words what it actually meant. And when I was going through my training, I was kind of... somewhat troubled by that. The same with Freudian psychology. You know, the terms id and ego and superego were kind of, we're so used to them that we kind of take them for granted. But I felt that when I really thought about it, I wasn't quite clear what an id really is. And then the ego supposedly comes out of the id or something. And I kind of got lost in that. And so I was kind of struggling to clarify what I was experiencing as a psychotherapist, and try to reformulate it. And then it turns out that my inquiries led into neuroscience. And so that what I've come up with is kind of a combination of a psychological theory that's based on neuroscience. And so we're, I think it then comes back and explains psychoanalysis. It's actually based on real neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of an interesting combination of a hard neuroscience approach and a psychological approach. And that I think often neuroscientists forget that there's a mind. And they get interested in neurons and chemicals and electrical fields and stuff. And I feel that at the end of the day, what we really have are minds. And it's interesting to see, you know, how the brain supports a mind or how it interacts with the mind. But that we really need to keep in mind the mind.
Well, it's interesting that what we might almost say is it's almost the difference between reading about new science, which has a spiritual spin, versus reading the Bible or something which may in fact have metaphors in it, or we may choose to believe it has metaphors. Jung and Freud were talking, and it's almost like now that we know how the brain, now that we have a sense, we don't really know, but now that we have a beginning sense of how the brain functions, it becomes less poetic, and maybe we begin to understand what is really going on. I'm thinking that one way to draw the listeners into the complex science of the brain hemispheres, you might want to start by telling us about what myths have grown up out of the early research finding on the nature of the personality traits that we've assigned to the right brain and the left brain. These,
right,
again, being
sure,
the opposite sides of the body, but...
Right, that the popular notion is that the left brain is logical and the right brain is poetic, and that we can classify people as left brain or right brain depending on whether they go to MIT or art school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there may be some truth to that, but we really don't have much evidence for it. In fact, we have some evidence to the contrary. It is clear that there are logical people, and there are poetic people, and there are people in between, and we can describe people that way. But whether that has to do with the hemispheres is in question. My studies have found, and what I'm... talking about, maybe I should get into that.
Some of the research. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it actually, I think, is not really so complicated. And in fact, it's in a way so simple. I think the best way to understand my work is to go back to the split brain studies. And these were studies done at Caltech in the early 60s by Roger Sperry, who won the Nobel Prize for that. And he was assisted by Joseph Bogan, Michael Gazzaniga, and Aran Zeidel. And Joe Bogan was a young resident in neurosurgery. And he went to Roger Sperry, who was a researcher in psychology. And he proposed treating epilepsy by cutting the connection between the two halves of the brain. The brain, like the kidneys or the lung, the lungs, is a double organ. And we don't usually think of that. We think of the brain, and actually we've really got two brains. And they're connected kind of like a walnut. You've got two wrinkly halves, and they're connected with a stem. The idea of this operation, which actually had been done in the early 40s for the first time, a few operations were done, and Joe Bogan wanted to revive it. And the idea was that if you cut the connection, if a seizure began on one side, it wouldn't be able to pass easily to the other side, and you might be able to control seizures that way. And it turns out that most of the patients were quite benefited by the surgery. the reason Roger Sperry won the Nobel Prize and had help from his colleagues on this was that he looked at these people very closely after the operation, and what he found was rather amazing. And it was not that the left brain was logical and the right brain was poetic. What he found was that there were two minds in these people. And let me explain what this means and why I make that statement that should sound that way outrageous. It turns out that the eyes are connected to the brain, so that if you show something to the right side of a split brain patient, it can only be seen by his left brain. And if you show something to the left side, it can only be seen by his right brain. And so by showing pictures to the right side of the patient, the person could tell you whatever you showed in the picture, just like an ordinary person. If you showed a picture to the left side of the person, the individual would say, I can't see it. Now, it turns out that speech is located in the left brain. And so when you showed something to the left side, it went to the right brain, and the right brain is mute. Now, if you ask the person, just like if we were talking with a mute person, you could communicate with him, but he just couldn't speak. He can understand language, but he'd have to talk with his hands or some other gesture, but he wouldn't be able to speak. So you say to the split brain patient, when you show a picture to the left side, it goes to the right brain, and you ask him to reach behind a screen and pull out the object. So the left brain says, I can't see it. That's the person talking. Only the left side talks. But the person reaches behind the screen and always pulls out the correct item. So if you show a picture of a keychain, he reaches behind the screen, pulls out a keychain. You flash a picture of a pipe, he pulls out the pipe. And he does it all the time correctly. And this has been done hundreds of times. What this means is that the right brain is separate from the left brain. And it's intelligent, that it understands the instructions, it carries out the task, it recognizes what's in the picture and feels around, and with its fingers it can detect the shape of the object, knows the correct object, and carries out the task. It's actually a fairly complicated task that requires an understanding of language to understand the instructions and then to carry out the task. And it's all done outside of the awareness of the person who you're talking to on the left side.
Which is part of what's startling about this, is that there can be a dominance. It means that there can be they're functioning separately, and they can function separately.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even neuroscientists have trouble with this. A lot of people just have trouble with the idea that you could have two minds, but it's really irrefutable that in split-brain patients, you clearly have two minds. In fact, you can show pictures to the right side of the split-brain patient, and you can ask for a thumb signal. And the first picture, the left brain is always the one who's talking, says, I can't see it. And the thumb goes up. It's a picture of Johnny Carson. The second picture gets thumbs down. It's a picture of Adolf Hitler. And the third picture gets a thumbs horizontal, and again the person says, I can't see it, because it's the left brain talking. And the thumbs horizontal was when Richard Nixon was flashed in the 1970s. So here you have a right brain who not only can pick out a pipe or a keychain, but he's got political opinions.
Well, let me just ID the show. This is you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I have by phone author of a remarkable new book called Of Two Minds. I have psychiatrist and researcher Dr. Frederick Schiffer. His book is published by Free Press and is available in hardbound, Of Two Minds. And we're talking about the science of dual brain and how it moves into psychology and psychoanalysis. Well, not psychoanalysis, but therapy.
Well, actually,
therapeutic. Psychoanalysis and therapy.
It does, yeah.
Okay. One of the things that is very chilling about all of this is when you get further into the book, incidentally, I could not, usually when I have a book to read, part of what I have to do just for time is scan pieces of it. And I was unable to do that with this book because I was so fascinated by it. I had to read every single word in the book.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's very nicely written, and it's fascinating. One of the things that was riveting was that there are instances where people are missing half of their brain.
That's right.
And they function quite well regardless of this. This is
That's
just
right.
amazing, you know?
That's right. That's right. And
then you've also got situations of hemisphere dominance, and I put that in quotes,
mm-hmm.
in persons that do not have split brains. So this goes back to this theory that you have a right brain personality or a left. And again, where you went with this, which was something that I was like a mystery novel I had to keep going, was that in fact, when you're dealing with people who have experienced trauma and abuse, and it's pretty hard to find anybody in the world who has not experienced some, that in fact brain development and hemisphere dominance is going to be influenced because abuse and stress, as we've discussed on this show so many times, the effects of increased amounts of glucocorticoid steroids on the body, it has a cascade effect, and this includes that it may stilt growth in one of the hemispheres of the brain. So where I'm going is that you may in fact have personalities that become dominant or less mature, as you put it in the book, based on what happens to the person as they're alive.
Yeah, what I have come to find is that the two hemispheres can have different personalities, and they can have a relationship like two different people. Now, I went out to the lab in California where the split brain studies were done in 1996. This is after Roger Spurrier's died, but I went out to work with Joe Bogan and Aaron Zeidel, and I was interested in the personalities of the two hemispheres in split brain patients. Most of the studies on split brain patients focused on language abilities or spatial tasks, more cognitive tasks, and I was interested more in a kind of a psychological information about the nature of these two hemispheres. And we devised a way to talk to both hemispheres simultaneously by lining pegs up in front of both hands. And we found this very reliable, that the patients could easily answer questions by pointing to a peg that represented none, mild, moderate, quite a bit, or extreme. So we could ask one side how confident... We would say on this scale, how much do you feel blank? And then a word would be flashed to the right side or the left side of a screen, and their hands and they would see different questions simultaneously. I don't know if it's getting confusing, but
no, it's okay.
Basically, we were able to interview both hemispheres of two split brain patients, and we were interested in psychological questions. How much do you like your mother? How much do you like your girlfriend? How do you feel about yourself? Things of this sort. And one of the patients mentioned, as we were setting up the equipment, I was chatting with him, that he had been bullied as a child. And I know from my experience as a psychotherapist that bullying is quite severe trauma, generally, and for many, many people when it occurs. And so I asked him if he were bothered by the bullying. He said, nah, it happened 35 years ago. And that's a typical response that I'll see in a patient who I know is in fact, bothered by it. So I asked 14 questions about how angry the bullies made him feel and how much he was still bothered by the bullies and questions along that line. And there were 14 of them. Then there were 35 general questions about how confident he felt and how he felt about his girlfriend. And on the general questions, his two sides responded quite similarly. On the bully questions, they diverged. And his left hand, talking for his right brain, indicated he was extremely upset by the bullies. His right hand, talking for his left brain, which had already told me that he wasn't upset, indicated that he was not upset by the bullies. And this is the kind of thing that I've been finding in my subsequent research. That it turns out that for many people, there are different perspectives on the world such that one side tends to be more troubled by past trauma and to view the world more the way they saw it as a child when they were being traumatized. And this is exactly what I saw in this particular split brain patient.
Well, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I then went on I was reading some studies about from a group in Germany that was purporting to show movies in intact people to one hemisphere or the other. And I was trying to figure out how he was doing it, because you shouldn't, according to what I understood, you shouldn't be able to show a movie to one half of the brain in an intact person, because they've got the connection between the two hemispheres intact. And whatever you show to one side should go over to the other side. But this group had written several papers, and they were showing that they got different heart rate responses, different blood pressure responses, different cortisol responses, and different emotional responses, depending on which side they showed the movie to in different populations. So I was intrigued by that, and as I read it over a number of times, I finally figured out what they were doing to show the movie to one side or the other. They in their protocol, it's hard to understand. They were tracking eye movements and masking a computer screen, but essentially they were just showing the movie to one side or the other. And it turns
Let me move you along a little bit so we don't run out of time. This led you, because of the research and because of other research that was done, this led you to actually, this was very high tech, but to tape up a pair of goggles so that
That's
people
right.
could only see out of one side of one eye.
That's
but,
right.
And then you did some very interesting experiments with that, with your patient population. One of the things I want to just intercede here is that one of the things that's interesting that people may be thinking about is, well, you know what, so what if there's a part of me, whether it's, which doesn't matter what side of the brain it is, there's some part of me that very quietly is not happy about something that happened in my past, but it's not expressing itself. So what difference does it make? What's interesting is that what you discovered is that it's not only expressing itself, but in very, very covert ways. So this starts to come into what we know in modern in what's been popular psychology now as, you know, having a mature and an immature personality or an inner child sort of adult kind of thing split.
Right.
But it also begins to speak to the idea of covert and overt depression, that there's something under the surface. And lest people believe that they're getting away with something that may be bothering them on some other level, what you discovered was that in very extreme situations, people's individual hands would start acting differently. Now, this must have been split brain. These were split brain people. But you had people attacking themselves with their left. This was the left hand. This reminds me, of course, of Dr. Strangelove, you know, the
right.
movie Doctor, where he's
right.
where he's trying to use it.
Yeah, these are split brain patients after
yes.
the surgery. That again, this is evidence that in split brain patients, there are two minds acting. And the left hand often will act for, it doesn't last a long time, but in a number of people who had the operation, the left hand acts intelligently. One guy wanted to smoke, and every time he lit a cigarette, his left hand would grab the cigarette and put it out.
And there was the woman who got slapped awake.
Yeah.
One morning.
Right. Yeah.
Well, but what this seems to imply, what we're learning from this then, is that when people say, boy, you know, I know what I'm supposed to do, and I just can't do it. Why can't I do it?
Yeah,
I don't.
That's right. Like someone who has an airplane phobia. And knows you know that it's safe to fly and wants to get on the airplane, but his feet won't let him.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that it's quite likely that in that person that one of the hemispheres or the mind of one of his hemispheres might have some reason that he's not aware of, probably due to some past trauma for not getting on the airplane or not wanting to get on the airplane.
Or a parent who
is
yeah.
on it.
Yeah, parent who was afraid of airplanes. Some message that came early on.
Right.
And the other thing that's interesting about this is that you, as you began to work with the goggles and whatnot, you began to be able to get conversations going with these two sides of the brain, and we're going to discuss that when we come back from break. It's I've lost my train of thought. This is actually the first time that's happened on the air, but it's. The thing that's extraordinary here also is that it so much speaks to this sensation that people have of not being able to understand. In other words, the stuff that lies under the surface now, instead of thinking that there's a sort of reservoir of pain, what we're beginning to discover now through your research is that there may also be two conversations going on that we don't have complete, we don't have an ear to. So we're shortly going to take, I'm trying to think of something I can ask you that's a short, well, why don't you go ahead and describe the goggles? And maybe it's important also, if you can do it quickly, is to tell us why in some people the goggles were extraordinary. They felt better on one side than the other. There was very black and white. And in some people that doesn't work. Why doesn't it work with some people?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, really. I have some thoughts about it. The people in whom it works, who get strong responses, it's absolutely amazing and unexpected that someone could look to one side and have a dramatic change in personality from what they're like when they look out the other side. I mean, this is even when I continue to experience it, each time it's surprising. And we've done placebo control studies, we've done EEG studies.
I'm going to have to stop you for a second because we're going to run out of time. What I was looking for from you is that what you said in the book is that some people, both hemispheres of the brain have been traumatized.
Yeah, or they might be both untraumatized, or they might be similar for some reason. Or in some people, one side might dominate the other side so much that you can't get the other side free.
Okay. All right, when we come back from break, we're going to continue this discussion with Dr. Frederick Schiffer, who is a psychiatrist and a researcher. His new book is called Of Two Minds, and we're discussing the science of dual brain psychology. I'm Lena Berman. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. We're going to take like a 30-second break, so we'll be right back.
We were like interlocking pieces in the jigsaw puzzle of life.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman. I'm doing a show with Dr. Frederick Schiffer, who is a psychiatrist and a researcher, who has a new book called Of Two Minds, which is published by Free Press. It is about the science of dual brain psychology, and we've been talking about the science of the two hemispheres of the brain and how they actually can function independently. And when we left, what I was talking about was this issue of maybe getting the two sides of the brain to have a conversation with each other. And Dr. Schiffer has developed a pair of, well, like I said, really what you did, but mostly was tape a pair of goggles so that you could see only out of the extreme side of one eye and the other.
And you can do the same thing with an like a letter-sized envelope. You don't even have to get that high-tech as tape and goggles. You can just hold an envelope up. And so that you cover one eye and the middle half of the other eye. And if you wanted, you could, actually try this. And you could.
You should see the engineers now. They're sitting in the room and they're covering their eyes.
Okay.
Is there anything I should do if something violent happens?
Well, good to do is to try to measure how you feel. I use a scale from 0 to 10.
Is it the case that severely disturbed people should not try this at home?
No, I think that if someone's uncomfortable, then they'll put the envelope down.
Yes.
You know, it's not. And it won't make anyone feel worse than they've ever felt.
Okay.
If you cover one eye and middle half of the other eye, and the people who respond within 15 seconds or so, and if you ask a person how much anxiety they feel from 0 to 10, 10 being high and 0 being none, and then switching over to the other side and looking out the lateral half of the other eye, So if you started looking out the left eye, so now you'd be looking out the right half of the right eye with the envelope covering. And in my practice, about 30% of patients have intense responses, and another 30% have maybe a one, two, or three point difference, and then 40% won't have any change, and they'll say, you know, what's this? Why are you asking me to do this? But in someone who has an intense response, what it's like is a patient will come in, usually someone with, say, depression and some anxiety, and I'll have them do it, and they'll feel somewhat more, usually they'll feel more of their symptoms when they look out one side, and then their symptoms are much less on the other side, and often it might be like an 8 to a 2, or in someone who really responds a lot. And it's not just how they feel, but it's also how they think. I have a patient, for example, who's typical of patients who respond, who will come in and look out his right side, and I'll ask him about how he feels about himself, and he'll say, I'm stupid and lazy, which is what his father always told him when he was a kid. And he'll look out the other side, and he'll say, "No, I'm bright as hell. I'm the most ambitious guy I know." And it's an amazing thing, and I see this over and over. So what I then do is I'll say, "Well, do you notice what you said on the other side?" And usually I get an answer like, "Yeah, isn't that strange?" And then what we use this for is to try to communicate with the troubled side and to try to teach it that it's more valuable and more safe than it thought. And it's hard to teach that side. It's kind of got its ideas and holds on to the negative view. But over time, it learns.
I would say even in people who, let's say that, you know, people are listening right now and they've jumped up and taken their sunglasses and they're very busily taping over different lenses and things and trying this. I would say even in a person who doesn't have extreme clinical symptoms but who experiences these odd sensations of, gee, some days, you know, it's a diamond and some days it's a stone and I don't know what the difference is. And, you know, we've kind of gone through the whole thing of looking at, because you don't discuss, I've discussed a lot on the show, the sorts of things that encourage happy chemical production in the body in terms of nutrition and you know, the omega-3 fats. There have been tremendous studies that even the AMA has recognized now.
Mm-hmm.
But that aside, just even so, you know, you do everything right, and then you go, gee, what is this? And those of us who have done a lot of therapy know that there's often a voice that we sometimes identify as a wounded child or something, and you can have conversations, but I would say even in someone without extreme symptoms, that there is something to be learned about this kind of capriciousness of mind.
Right.
That's valuable about this research.
That's right. Even patients who have no response to the envelope or the goggles, they're helped by the fact that other people have this response and that it says something about how the mind works. So even in people who aren't having this experience, it gives a concept of mind and of changes in attitude and how we can look at something and it all looks pessimistic, and then at another time it nothing's really changed, but it looks very different. I had a patient last week who was upset about something and looked at me and he said, "You look menacing."
Mm.
And he was looking at one side. I said, "Well, why don't you look at the other glasses?" And he said, "No." I said, "You look sad, but you don't look menacing." And I said, "Well, I don't think my expression changed." He said, "Yeah, you changed your expression." And we went back, and he said, "You know, you look menacing here." I said, "Well, I think if you were looking at a photograph of me, the photograph would look different." He said, "No." He said, "You've changed your expression." So I took a photograph. I have some photographs in the office here of some famous people, and one was a photograph of Paul Robeson, and he looked out one side and he said, "Oh, he looks menacing," and he looked out the other side and he said, "No, he looks sad," and then he laughed, and he saw that it was coming from him, and it's really interesting. Now, also, I have sunglasses that are constructed. It took a long time to get them right, but they let a little more light in on one side than the other, and remarkably, patients can feel these kinds of changes. People who respond to it can feel really a dramatic change just by putting on these sunglasses.
There's no question that in our development things happen. Even in families where parents are trying very hard to do the right thing, there's things from their past that interfere, and then there are just experiences like the bully, you know, the one who was
right.
bullied on the schoolyard that can't be controlled. Mm-hmm. So there's any number of things. There's racism in this country, you know, there's sexism. I mean, there's all kinds of things that cause stressful responses in the body, and there's no question that elevated amounts of cortisol cause damage in some, so like I said, in a cascade sort of way, that affect all of the neurotransmitters and the hormones, and everything gets affected by the cortisol. But another thing that happens is something that even very early on Hans Selle was studying, and other researchers, about learned helplessness and depression, this issue of feeling that, as you put it in your book, you get to a point where you expect re-traumatization. You expect things to be bad. You know, that's part of one of the colors of depression, is that kind of expecting things to be hopeless or bad. Mm-hmm. And so there's a way that there's a learned helplessness that occurs. Very often people will give up and can't express their anger, so that as you say in the book again, and other psychologists have talked about, this internalization of the aggressor, the angry voice of a parent, whatever it was. So clearly, goggles alone are not enough. Supportive therapy is very important. And when you were talking about, gee, you look menacing, you don't look menacing, the role of transference in therapy is very important. And I'd like you to talk about that a bit, why the therapeutic environment is important.
Well, use the term transference. And I think that a lot of terms from psychoanalysis take on a different meaning from this theory. In other words, what we would think of as the unconscious was really when the immature part works below the surface. If the immature part dominates the personality and the person normally acts immature most of the time, it's really not unconscious. It's an immature personality that's dominating. But if a person generally has their mature part leading, but they're interfered with through a troubled side, then it would be kind of a traditional view of it it would be functioning as an unconscious mind, the troubled mind, and then we would say that we would interpret what the person is doing, and the psychologist or therapist would offer an interpretation, which really was a translation for what the troubled mind was trying to do or thinking. And transference, I think, really what we mean by that is the relationship between the troubled side and the therapist. So when this patient felt that I was menacing, this was important because his father had abused him. So the idea that I would be menacing had to do with his negative experience with his father, and our function in therapy is to try to help the troubled mind in him learn that he's now in a different situation and that he's now safe. And the goggles or the sunglasses are very helpful in therapy because they enlist the healthy part as another therapist. And it turns out that people who respond to the goggles, according to a review of my own data, it's not a real scientific study, but a review of it shows that there's a good correlation between people who respond intensely to the glasses and people who have the strongest recoveries. And I think it might be because when people respond, they have another tool that's very powerful to help them in teaching the troubled side that things are better.
Yeah, as I said earlier, in a psychological environment with a therapist, a good therapist can often get you to begin to have a dialogue from the adult part of you to the part of
right.
you that feels less able.
Right.
And that's part of what can happen in a therapeutic situation. Even a good friend sometimes can help you with that. But what's extraordinary here is that you worked with some patients who were really kind of beyond the pale in terms of what people knew what to do for them. Like you had a patient who had a psychosis, who'd had
right.
a psychiatric
mm-hmm.
break,
mm-hmm.
A breakdown. And again, what's extraordinary here is that it's one thing to say, see, you have a strong side, you've achieved these things, and it's another thing to say that to yourself and to know it, to feel it.
Here was a patient who had been doing well. He'd had a psychotic break a number of years earlier and was doing well and had some stress and started he fell off and he was not functioning and he was a graduate student and had trouble functioning. And I was trying with all of the skills that I knew and all the medicines I could come up with to try to pull him out of the psychosis, and I wasn't able to. And one night I decided to try the glasses, which I was reluctant to use because he was having a psychosis. And one side he put them on and his face screwed up and he said, "I don't trust you, doctor." So I said, "Try the other side." And he laughed. He said, "Of course I trust you." And he was clear as a bell for the first time in 2 months, and it was an amazing transformation. And so I gave him we worked back and forth that evening, and in that session we talked to the troubled side, and it was a remarkable session, and he recovered actually quite quickly, as these things go. It was a matter of weeks as opposed to sometimes people never coming out of it. So I asked him to write something up, since he was a scientist, about his experience. And I gave him a pair of glasses to take home. Actually, I called him the next day, and he was back in his psychosis. And I said, "Are you wearing the goggles?" He said, "No." I said, "Why not?" He said, "I guess the other side doesn't want me to."
Mm.
So he wrote this up, and this is in my book. He wrote two paragraphs, and one says, "Without glasses." And he writes, "I would say the experience with Dr. Schiffer Friday night was fairly impressive, but who really cares? I feel like I need help right now just to get through anything in life. I'd like to get my hair cut, to not feel in control enough of my thoughts to do so. I just want to be able to control my thoughts." Then he has a second paragraph. It says, "With glasses. It's much harder to type with funny glasses on. Must persevere. I think the glasses experiment was phenomenal and shows the power of the little boy inside, more like a petulant child at the moment. Our goal must be to make him sit down in his chair and let the adult part lead."
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. You're listening to an interview with Dr. Frederick Schiffer, who is a psychiatrist and a researcher. He's written an extraordinary new book called Of Two Minds, which is, the subtitle is The Revolutionary Science of Dual Brain Psychology. It's published by Free Press. I'm Lena Berman. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I should remind you that if you miss parts of today's show and you want to get a taped copy of today's show, or you need information in general about the show, you can call the information number 24 hours a day at 707-773-4727. Or you can go to the website, you delete www, and you type in members.aol.com/YOHAF. I'll give that out again at the end of the book. Some people may be wondering about the relationship between dual brain science and multiple personalities. And before we talk about that, it might be useful to also explain why schizophrenia is not dual brain. That it's not about multiple personalities. People think schizophrenia
that's
right. is...
Right. Schizophrenia does not mean a dual personality. It's more just a general collapsing of a whole personality, It's only dual in the sense of a person can get sick and then recover and then get sick and recover and kind of
have cycles.
Yeah, or get stuck in one or the other. If they get stuck if they don't recover or recover and not have it happen. But the idea of a split personality is really a misnomer. But there are patients who are considered multiple personality disordered patients, and there's a researcher in New Jersey who has some new data with such patients. I don't have any in my practice, but he came up with some remarkable findings. And again, I want to say that these findings have been tested in the laboratory with the brainwave studies, and we've used we just finished an interesting study using a thing called a transcranial magnetic stimulation, all of which shows that these findings are not due to suggestion, or at least we have a great deal of evidence showing that these are actual phenomena, and there's more of that in the book.
My impression from reading your book is that the sense that you had is that you're dealing again with this issue of different parts who don't have voice or who have a covert voice and a voice that's hidden or underlying, and it's
right.
Seeking to communicate. You discovered some very interesting things about substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was going to say about multiple personality.
Yeah.
What this psychologist Tom Tudor from New Jersey at a symposium that I was at, he presented a videotape of a patient who he said was typical of of nine patients with multiple personality, and he would put the goggles on and ask the person how close different personalities were, how far away is Mary and how far away is Betty, and the patient would say Betty's very near now and Mary's far away, and it turned out that all of the negative alters were on were when she wore one pair of glasses. They were all near. Even though they weren't in order, there were 10 different alters that she had, but the positive alters and more mature alters were all located on one side. So this, it's very interesting. And in terms of addiction, in my book I have a chapter on cocaine addiction. I had two patients come back to my office whom I had treated dozen years earlier, and they had good outcomes, and I had them put the glasses on, and they got all of their problems back that they had on one side. And I asked one of the patients at the end of the interview whether he'd ever use cocaine again, and he said, of course not. I said, how about on the other side? He said, you know, I could see myself doing it on the other side.
You discovered that sometimes it's the lows that are addictive to people who have addiction problems, that sometimes
right.
They're actually addicted to, it sort of goes back to the learned helplessness and the
mm-hmm.
expectation of
right.
re-traumatization. So you're redoing the abuse because there's some part of you that's, again, covert, or a covert that's under
right.
the surface that really believes that that's the way you should be treated, that's the way things should be. And in the absence of a abusive person on the outside, you've got one on the inside. So, again,
right.
this is another way for the parts to communicate.
The compulsion to repeat. That's what Freud talked about that.
Yeah. You also discovered some interesting things. You know, part of what we're talking about here is the part of our brain that's very old, and the relationship between the old brain struggling with the frontal cortex, which suppresses the lower center, and you again talking about how cortisol levels shrink the hippocampus too. So
right.
there are actual. I mean, I'm always tempted to sort of throw in my two cents about nutrition and these sorts of things, the depression, because there's tremendous research using, again, the omega-3 fatty acids in fairly high doses, and some of the amino acids which help to build some of these good neurotransmitters. There's some amino acids that increase serotonin levels and things like that. So when people are really having a problem with impulse control. One thing I was interested in, too, is that you had a few patients that you mentioned in the book who you used medication on them so that you could actually do therapy, I mean, essentially, so that you could do the work. Mm-hmm. And some of them improved remarkably. When would you not, why wouldn't you automatically sort of try to wean people off meds? I mean, in some cases they're still on meds, although they're doing well, they're doing better. Why not try to wean them off?
I like not to use medication unless what I'm doing still leaves a person in a lot of distress. And so if my ministrations aren't pulling a person out of distress, and if there's something that might help them, I think that the antidepressants, for example, are way overrated.
Oh, I so agree with you.
In actual studies, they don't do much better than
I really
placebo.
Agree with you. They also do some harm, unfortunately. I mean, there are some side effects that are rather not so great with some of them. So,
mm-hmm. But if I'm treating someone and they're really suffering and there is something that other people at least have confidence in and I'll give that a try. And so. And sometimes when a patient's been on a medicine and they're doing better, they're reluctant to come off it.
Okay.
And so I try to encourage people to come off medication as they're feeling better, and usually they do.
Oh, good.
But sometimes they're reluctant to, and I tend to follow what patients want in terms of going on or off medication.
You were personally very moved and grateful for the psychoanalysis you had as a resident.
Mm-hmm.
You got to work
yes.
with somebody remarkable.
Yes.
How has your research changed the way you work with your own moods and psychology, personally, if you don't mind talking about it?
I'm actually one of the people who don't respond to the glasses. Except there have been a couple of occasions, usually like in the middle of the night, if I've been under some stress and worried about something, and on just the two occasions that come to mind where I put them on and I had that experience of feeling differently on one side versus the other, and it was actually an impressive experience for me. And there's no doubt that I have a little boy inside me. It's just that the glasses don't bring him out easily. But I'm quite comfortable with the little boy within.
Well, you communicate. You communicate pretty well. It sounds
like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's communication. Now, people are listening to the show and they're thinking, all right, I want a pair of those goggles, I want a pair of those sunglasses. And
mm-hmm.
my sense is, I mean, we didn't discuss this before we went on the air, but I'm wondering whether, well, first of all, you haven't mass-produced these goggles and these glasses, so.
Well, actually.
Or actually, have you?
I have, actually.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, let me say this then. Is there a way that you'd like people to get in contact with you? And if so, what you'd like them to get in contact with you for, besides... You know, they're getting the book of Two Minds, again, by Frederick Schiffer.
If people want to get some more information about this, I have a website.
Good.
And the glasses are described there. So it's called, www.schiffermd.com.
That's easy.
Is
MD with periods between it?
No, it's
and is it Schiffer MD one word?
It's all one word.
SchifferMD.com.
That's right.
Okay. Well, what I'll do is I will put that on my website,
okay.
And I will also put it on the front desk of KPFA, which is 510-848-6767, and you'd go to the receptionist if people miss it. But I will put it up on my website. But your website, again, is www.schiffer, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R, SchifferMD, one word, all small case, .com. And there's information on how to get your glasses.
And also I have papers and
oh, goody.
There's some information about the book and just some general information as well.
Well, I really thank you for writing this book. I found it very illuminating, and I've recommended it to several psychologists that I'm friends with.
Well, thank
you. I really appreciate it, and I'm very grateful for you to spend this time with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Frederick Schiffer, author of Two Minds about Dual Brain Psychology. Again, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you for listening. Again, if you missed portions of today's show and you want to hear it again on a copy, you can get cassette copies. I don't have transcripts available. And to get information on how to order them or what other shows are around on this series, Your Own Health and Fitness, whether shows are available, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-773-4727. 707-773-4727. You can get the tape list also on the web site, and the information like this Dr. Schiffer's web will be on there as well. My website, what you do is you delete www and you type in members.aol.com/YOHAF, Your Own Health and Fitness. If you'd like a copy of the tape list on paper, you can send me a self-addressed business-sized envelope with two stamps to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. Next week, a health insurance update. I'm going to have insurance broker Gregory McDonald on. We had him on last year about this time, and we'll talk about what's up with the incredible new increases in the rates for health insurance and how to protect yourself and maintain.